I figured we'd do some type of introduction since this has never happened before. Make a little more sense. Today, we have a little bit of a different show than normal. We have our first planned guest. This is Matthew. I should have asked you how to say your last name. Matthew
Sweden.
Sweden?
Well, I was real close.
Sweden.
Yeah.
Okay. Of Simplewood Goods. We've been messaging back and forth on Instagram for quite a while. He has a very cool business that uses robots and CNC routers and coding. And so we're akin in a lot of ways. And so we were like, let's actually have a guest. Let's talk to Matthew. And so here it is.
Sweet.
Well, thanks for joining. I'm very excited to join you guys. So thanks for having me. And yeah, I was just saying that I've appreciated listening to the podcast. So it's awesome to get to be a part of it. So thanks.
Awesome. So like, I feel like we've pinged messages back and forth. I was looking through our message like history last night. It's like, cool. Yeah, we've exchanged a few messages and kind of talked robots a little bit and machines a little bit and Grasshopper a little bit. But like, in reality, I don't actually know that much about your business at all. So, like, do you want to introduce yourselves for us, but and the audience of like what you do and who you are and how you became the Lord of Vinyl Boxes?
There we go. Yeah. So let's see. Similar to Justin, I studied architecture in grad school. I grew up like working on houses. I did that before I went to school. I wanted to be an architect. Did it for a couple years after grad school, and I absolutely hated it. Like, would get off the train and be walking to the office and just get this pit in my stomach, like, I don't want to do this. So it was 2014. I was dating my now wife. We didn't have kids. We didn't have a mortgage. We moved from Boston back to Ohio, and it's so cheap here. And I had a lot of friends that were starting businesses, and like, just looking through sketchbooks, it's like, you don't really draw for pleasure. At a building scale, you mostly draw at a furniture scale. Like that's that combined with even in grad school, like I spent more than half my time in the shop hanging out down there, more than I should have really, but learned a lot of valuable lessons. So kind of all those things put together, it's like, let's give it a go, see what happens. I was really interested in like e-commerce opening up possibilities for small shops that, you know, you can be in Ohio and all of our customers are on the coast. So you don't have to live by people with lots of money to be able to sell to them. So I gave it a try and like, I didn't really know what the focus of the business was going to be until I had a couple of products, but I had a friend, I grew in high school and college, played a lot of music. I had a lot of friends that collected records and one of my buddies was like, there's like IKEA stuff and then there's like super boutique stuff, but there's really like not much in between that's, you know, so there was a big hole in the market and we did a couple early versions of our, like the storage cube that's now like the base of our business. But the third one around kind of, you know, I definitely would do it differently now, but it clicked, it was successful. And it basically from then on, it's just been an operations game, like chasing, trying to get faster, trying to get cheaper, adding other components to that. We have a modular system that we sell basically to vinyl record collectors, and there's something for LPs, there's something for 45s. We added stuff for CDs and DVDs now, and we've got like a little metal base that gets everything up the ground. So the idea was to design this flexible, modular, somewhat portable storage system, and it found a good market for itself. And I've been spending the past 10 plus years just dialing that in. So
10 years. Well, congrats. I'm super curious. I mean, as you know, having listened to this, like Justin and I have sort of battled to find focus. We've gone from like job shop work, saying yes to kind of anything and everything. And both of us are now on a more sort of focused product trajectory, I would say, to speak on your behalf, Justin. Somewhat. Like, how intentional was it for you to, like, get into, like, it sounds like you're very focused on a sort of single product ecosystem with accessories and stuff. Like, was there a stage in the business where it was more omnidirectional?
Absolutely. When I first started, we did, like, the goal was always to do home goods, but I wasn't, like, now, like, 90%+ of our business is that sort of family of products. So I did some chairs. I did some, like, coat hooks, other little home goods. We did tables for a while. But the more the the cubes just sort of took off, and it became like, okay, this is where our bread and butter is. So let's get really good at doing it. I did, I had a lot of, when I moved back here, some designer friends that would hire me to do custom work. So I did that for the first couple of years as well. But at some point, like, it's kind of diminishing returns when it's, for me at least, I mean, it is more fun. You get a new challenge, but it's not as lucrative because you're not getting the efficiencies of making the same thing 10, 20, 30,000 times. And it just was like, there's not enough hours in the day basically to continue to take custom work and keep up with orders. So it wasn't intentional to get so focused. And I think it's kind of a weak spot of my business that we're so dependent on one material and one market basically. Jim, I had a similar, like in 2022, we use all Baltic birch. I did not know that it all comes from Russia and Ukraine. So when that war happened, I was like, oh, just get it. I can get it from Canada. I can get it from anywhere else that's my latitude, right?
That's gonna ask, yeah.
Nope. It was brutal. So we were up to like, I think 11 or 12 people at that time, and we couldn't get materials. We had sold a bunch of stock. We had sold stuff, and I had ordered materials that just never arrived. So we like almost ran out of cash. I had to let go basically my entire team. That was really hard, but it was actually really good. Like I had already bought a UR sort of around that time, but it went from 12 people to me, and I was like, okay, I need to make sure that this thing is like doing a lot of work. So that was a really good year we're still running the line now. It's been revised, but like that was when I kind of really spent a lot of time. Our business got cut by a third because we stopped all our marketing, blah, 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 but did just enough to keep it alive. And then it's really been a business that's a lot more focused on automation. We have the same size team as we had last year. It's me plus three full-time guys and one part-time guy. But we're doing double the volume, and like, I really want to try and keep it that way. So for me, like, name of the game is just like, what's the thing that's either taking the longest or the most boring work, and can we get a machine to do that faster or easier? Or
yeah, awesome.
Right,
super cool.
I'm gonna make an attempt here too. I'm putting in some notes. As you know, we do this on YouTube. Matthew has sent us some amazing videos of his, what do you call it, the assembly line?
Yeah,
your line of, yeah. So we've talked about this before. I think we brought it up in the show. He sent us some amazing videos. So I'm going to try and drop some of it in if you want to watch it. So you want to check out the YouTube. And also my voice is, you know, of course, funky today. So Jen's going to do all the talking.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how much you wanted to share about the UR sort of stuff. Because, you know, I think that was probably our first interaction with you. We were talking robots, I don't know, a year ago or something, and you DM'd us a video of this crazy cool setup with URs. I couldn't even tell. Is it one or two?
It's just one. Yeah.
Just one. Okay,
we bought another one. So it's sitting in a storage container, but I'm almost ready to get that one out. So
sick. That was pretty exciting.
I've watched that video so many times.
Yeah.
It's funny. I think I mentioned this when I sent it to you too. Like I've never talked about that publicly. Like we don't put videos of it up much because I think, and I don't know to what extent this is true or not, but like I've always had the sense that people think that when they're ordering from a small company that's like in Ohio, it is still handmade. Like there's people making it. I still touch some stuff, but like everything gets touched a lot of times by four people in the shop. But yeah, we use a robot to finish things. You know, our guys are gluing stuff up. They put it in a case clamp, they'll pull it out, they put it on a conveyor belt, and it goes to the robot, and the robot will sand everything. Spray it. We use water-based finish. It sprays water-based finish on the machined edges of the parts. We're using pre-finished material, but everything that gets machined needs to get finished. And then it's on a second conveyor and kind of dries for a while and then gets fed back in and does it again and then goes to the end and somebody else unloads it. And then the last steps are still all done by hand. So we use a lot of masking to make sure we're not getting overspray all over everything, but somebody pulls the mask off, knocks all the edges down, make sure everything's nice and clean, puts the feet on, puts it back on. So yeah, that was that kind of part of the line is what it's not a fun job to like stand in front of to sand the same edge for 8 hours and then spray finish on it. It's like, this is, it's not fun for anybody. But yeah, that's been a big unlock.
Yeah. Yeah. Super cool. And
so you haven't shared it much. Do you not want to share it?
No, I'm happy to share it.
Be sharing it?
It's funny. I was thinking about this earlier. Like, I think it's, I don't know. I was like, I don't know, apprehensive about it. Cause like, you never know what people perceive your brand as, but it's, I'm excited about this. That's the stuff I get really excited about. So just be honest about it. And
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think like everyone listening here too. Thing.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the right audience for sure.
Sorry, Justin.
No, this is the standard Jem and Justin talk over each other because of the delay. But I was going to say, I mean, I think we talk about it a lot, but just in general, it's the way that we have to work in America to like, you know, make things and make the margins and be smart about how things go. So, you know, I think the easy answer is always nobody wants to do that job. And we would rather do the Pearson thing and say, well, let's use our brains and not our brawn, you know, over and over again. So I think it makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I suppose if your marketing only is like, we hand chisel your box out of a solid log, like maybe don't show it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then they'd really be expensive.
Yeah.
That's Twig and Bot.
I don't think the price sensitive people on Reddit will be listening to this episode. So
that's true. You're good. True.
So I'm so curious about the UR thing, and I had hoped we'd get into it. How did you end up with the UR? Like, what's your, like, you've, some of the stuff you've shown us makes us think that you're a closet software developer.
Oh, yeah.
And
yes,
but also robotics, some of the code you've been doing for a while. This is pre-vibe coding too, that stuff you shared with us the other day. So like,
right.
How?
Yeah, I forgot to mention. So after I started, let's see, where did this work out? My wife's a software developer. I've always been like into software, especially open source stuff. And I'm trying to think what year this was, like 2018, 2017. I started working on an open source project called Speckle, which is awesome. It's like an open data platform for the AEC industry. It's trying to compete with Autodesk and do some of the things that Revit does, but it's more about sharing data between different platforms. But I thought it was incredible. It's a great way to interface with Grasshopper in the web and Grasshopper in other things. So I started working on that and really like contributing to that project. And one of the guys there, the guy who founded it, is just incredible, very encouraging person. And was like, so I learned a lot from him. And then eventually after doing that for a year or two, got a job working at Woods Bagot as a digital design like specialist, basically, and just writing code for architects to like, ooh, is there a repetitive task in Rhino? Like, let's figure out a way to make that easier.
Cool.
And Justin, it's funny, you mentioned something a couple of weeks ago about being in grad school and kind of finding your tool. Like, I think we're talking about some people like to sketch. Yeah. Some people like to code.
Yeah.
Like, and but me, it was like, if we're going to make this model, like I got most excited about like, can I script a way to make the little ribs perfect? You know, like it was like, I should have known then, but yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did a lot of. You're
doing the same thing now out of boxes.
Exactly. So I kind of like dipped a toe in the water that way. And I've always been really interested in the marriage of computers and making physical things. So it's been a good outlet for it.
Is that a computer drawing behind you? CNC drawing?
This is a buddy of mine. It's a print, but it looks like a computer drawing, which is why I was like, yes, I want that one. Yeah. it's got that vibe.
You draw like a computer. I love it.
Yeah.
Off the back of that, can we talk about Beaver?
Sure, for sure. Probably need a new name for that, but it's like, see, got to get with the rhino or like the, you know, the rhino ecosystem. Everything needs to be an animal, like we're chewing wood. Let's do it. I was using, this was around the same time, 2019. I probably was still working at Woods Bagot at the time. I'm not sure. Might have started it before, but I was only working there 30 hours a week. I was still running the business like the other 10 hours a week. I had staff that were kind of doing all the production stuff, but I got frustrated with RhinoCam. I used MasterCam in grad school, which was awesome, but like so expensive. Wasn't going to use it, so I was using RhinoCam, but it was pretty buggy at the time. Like if you manipulated the geometry, it wouldn't always remember when you reopened the file, like what things were being referenced. And I had enough crashes, and it was, you know, you had to buy a new license every year. It was like, this is annoying. I'm cutting 2D shapes. I think it's not that complicated. Like, let's try it.
Yeah.
So, and I think I was looking back at like my commit history. The very first thing was like, let's make a parametric drawer. Like, it's just a box. It needs rabbits, and that's basically it. So like, let's figure out how to do that. And sort of just been as needed, adding little components to it. So I use that. I've been using that exclusively for 8+ years for all of our programming. But yeah, it's kind of just like whenever there's a new problem, we'll add a new component or a new feature to it. And I was familiar enough with how, like just having used manual CAM software enough, I'm like, I know how you program the drawing, but then you need something to communicate between the specific machine you're running it on and the geometry that's being decided. So like, well, let's make a really dumb post processor that kind of translates between the two. So it's been a really, it's a fun project. Whenever I need to do something new on it, that's like a good day. I'm like, oh yeah.
Nice.
To tweak
so
it.
That's still your production CAM system, is that the beaver that you made? Wow.
Yep.
And, super cool.
Yeah, I should do some tutorials on, like, I know how to use it, but like, it is not intuitive. There's no icons. There's like, it needs a little touch up, but it is, I mean, it's pretty useful. So for, at least for like pretty basic stuff, like I don't think it wouldn't be up to snuff for some of the stuff you're doing, Justin, but like, yeah, cutting basic shapes. It's like pretty good. It was fun. We switched from, when I moved to this shop in, 2020, it was like peak COVID. We were supposed to close like the week after COVID hit. It was not fun, but I'd been running an old multicam that was at least 20 years old, and like I was spending like a third of my time just making sure it was up and running. But switched from that to, we're running an Anderson Stratos Nest now, and like having to update Beaver for like a much more modern machine was a fun problem. It has a drill bank. It's got all these other features. So kind of learning how to program for that parametrically was pretty fun as well.
What's your work-life balance like?
Oh, it's good. Like I'm really...
Yeah, you're good?
Yes. It hasn't... I mean, I've got 4 kids. They're 6 and under.
Nice.
So if I'm not home at a reasonable hour, like it's not... I don't want to miss out on that, but also it's just not fair to my wife. But I'm usually like... I'm 9 to 5:30... 5 days a week. I don't work on the weekends. Occasionally I'll do like coding stuff or, you know, kind of like admin stuff I'll do at night after the kids go to bed occasionally, but that's pretty rare. It's taken me a while to get to that, but it's funny. I just had a customer, and this is not great. I'm sure it's like not a good business move, but customer wasn't available to call me during the day and didn't want to do things over email and kept just being like, well, why don't you just call me at night after you put your kids to bed? Why don't you just call me on the weekend? I'm like,
sure.
I kind of decided a long time ago, like, I'm not going to do that. That was one of the reasons why I didn't want to do architecture. It's like, you're working 12-hour days.
No boundaries.
Yeah. And like getting calls on the weekend. Like that's why I don't do that. So, you know, I'm sure I lost a sale because of that, but it's working for me. So, and yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Now I'm just always curious about that. Like when, because like I find those sort of, you know, for instance, Grasshopper code expansion development sort of projects, for me, I can only seem to make those happen after hours, of my work day. Like I don't know whether it's a focus thing or what I think is a priority during business hours. But yeah, I find it very hard to sort of pack that sort of stuff into a standard
work day burnout. I'm curious about you guys. What's your like percentage of time being in production, or like, are you out on the floor a lot, or like, how's your day? What does your day look like?
You go, Justin.
I sit here a lot, right where you see me, without a microphone in my face, no weird lights behind me. When we're trying out new things, trying to get new products going, whenever we're doing like job shop work, especially with our mill, that's primarily me. But otherwise, I am sitting at a computer far too much. And I can always tell how long I've been sitting at my desk because my neck starts to hurt. I'm like sitting like, oh, it's been, I need to get up and do something. But yeah, it's, I mean, similar, right? It's like I've designed this life for myself, luckily, with this business that hopefully will continue to pay me in a better way. But it's, this is what I was working on new product stuff today, and I was like, God, this is great. You know, like once I get past the stress of buying machines, I love this. So lucky in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I sit here all day pretty much. This is my setup. I'm sitting in my little pile of junk. I get on the floor to stretch basically at the moment, and that's about it.
Same, yeah.
And I'm currently in a good state of getting up, getting in early, and getting some time on the floor commissioning the robots. And that's a high distraction level for me at the moment. And so I'll sneak out away from the quoting desk and go and play with the robots for an hour during the day sometimes. But yeah, I'm not in production at all, per se.
Yeah, occasionally if I'm sitting, like if I'm in the, I get a pretty good mix of, like I do a lot of shop improvement stuff has been like
nice
60-70% of my year this year. We like,
cool.
I decided to, I, when I founded the business, I thought it was like a woodworking shop, but I kind of realized last year, like this is more of like a warehouse and logistics. That's what we are. Like, we need to get things in and out quickly and cheaply, et cetera. So I kind of set some goals in the beginning of the year. Like, we need to get our lead times were really bad last year, like 3 to 4 weeks plus for like, it's just a box, you know, shouldn't take that long to get it out the door. I've spent most of my time this year rearranging the shop, making more room for inventory. And like, I thought I'd be done by June, but like, I just finished off the new woodworking area. So we got a new pallet racking in. It's satisfying. Like, didn't go as quickly as I wanted to, but like, okay, I think we're getting on the right footing right when we're about to get really busy. So that's satisfying. But yeah, if I do happen to be sitting in the office for like an extended period of time and not doing that stuff, I get bored, I get antsy, I gotta go do something. Look, what are they up to out there?
Yeah. Yeah, the new shop looks super clean, nice.
Yeah, it's funny. I cut a board in there for the first time the other day. I was like, oh, this is so much nicer than, I mean, the other shop was amazing when we first got it too, but like, there's nice lighting, there's windows, it's, yeah.
And is it just adjacent next door? Like, what's the...
Yeah, our shop is like, it's a rectangle. The original buildings were an L shape on the outside, so it's only like 18 feet wide. And then somebody at some point filled in the L shape with a big steel building that's like 4,500 square feet. So this was like, before I was here, was a fastener company that had tons of offices. It's just me in an office, so I don't need 1,200 square feet of offices. So I kind of took out two of the old offices and made that the woodworking room. Mine's eventually going to be this will be the metal working room, hopefully next year. And then I'm going to move to this. My office is going to be the server room. So tiny little closet. That's all I really need. Nice. You know.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you got... Well, on that, yeah, go Justin.
Go Jim.
No, you can't. No, you.
I was going to ask about this later, but it's probably an easy answer. Would you do the epoxy floors again?
Yes, 100%. Like, they look great. And they weren't, I was expecting it to be more expensive. It was like $4,500 for 600 square feet, which is not cheap, but like, they look great. They feel great. They've got a nice texture. Like, when you sweep them, like, it's like so clean looking. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would do it again. And they were in and out, and they ground it in one day and then they put the epoxy down the next day and it looked really good.
That's the epoxy flake stuff. Yeah, sick.
Yeah, you have to wait like a day to walk on it, 2 days to put machines on it. But they did it. Luckily, they did it right before I was going out of town for 2 days. So like, I wasn't tempted to move stuff in early. You can if you want to. So.
Well, I neither have the money for it or the time, because I just found out my UMC is likely coming Monday. So the decision's been made. I'm not putting Epoxy down.
Yeah. So exciting.
Ding, ding, ding.
I just need to figure out how to clean it a little bit. The floor's pretty dirty in the old space.
Sick. Exciting. What's on your, other than a UR and a second one coming, and you mentioned an Anderson something CNC, like you've obviously got that new space with some more traditional woodworking equipment. Like what's on your list of equipment? Like what are you running?
Let's see. In terms of like on a typical product flow?
Yeah.
So I'm almost everything we're making, we bring material in, racks right next to the router. Everything gets cut out on the CNC router. And then it kind of branches, like cubes have one line. We have some custom built case clamps that we made that are like, they only make the one size product, but it's been that one was like 20 plus versions to get it working. And now they're a little out of square again. So I've got to go back and revisit that, but
they look amazing.
That was great. And then, so like cubes go to those little custom case clamps, and then down the UR, it's just got a pneumatic sander. I bought like a, I forget who makes it, maybe Graco, like made for a robot spray on eBay. And it works great. That took a lot of time to figure out how to get the settings dialed in. But, and then we just have like a downdraft table and a pneumatic DA at the end. Everything gets stacked up. We've got like, so there's, I mentioned the branch in our, like in our line right now. So the box gets made on one, but our 45 storage, our CD, DVD storage and stereo cab all get made on that second line. And that one's a lot more manual. So we've got like a handheld biscuit joiner that we do the mitered corners on. We put biscuits in the miters. That all gets done by hand. Then it goes to a hand-based, you know, gets finished by hand, gets sprayed by hand. And that's really, our margins are not as great on those because it's a time intensive, like labor intensive process. So the other thing I've been working on this year, other than kind of shop optimization is, and a bit, it's been fun like hacking away at this bit by bit, but I'm trying to get an automatic edge finishing system in place. So I've done a bunch of trial runs. I did like an LED cured oil. It looked great, but like the machine I made for it wasn't great. And then it still came out a little bit rough. So one day I was like, I bought like a buffer to just try and like smooth it out. And I was like, oh, this is nice. And then I was like, what if you put a little wax on that? So I bought some Carnauba wax and just like touched the buffer with it and then buffed it out. And it was like so smooth. And I was like, what if you just skip the LED cure? Let's see what that does. And it was hilarious. I spent like, I don't know, a lot of hours making this LED cured finishing machine. And like, it was immediately blown away by just like putting some wax on a buffer, buffing it. And it like looks great. It looks just like the pre-finished stuff. So we had this old edge bander that's, I used to make cabinets. I built cabinets for my house with it, but we don't edge band any of our products. So it's like some of the trim functions weren't working. It was fine. It would, you know, flush cut the top and bottom, but wouldn't do the end. So it was like, it was old. It wasn't in great shape. So I just pulled everything out of there. It's got the like perfect feed mechanism in it for finishing the edges. And so I've spent the past couple of weeks getting that up to speed. I just before this call got the electronics all working. So there's a chain feed that pushes the material through, and then the spindle that's going to get the buffer mounted to it, and still have to figure out how to get that mounted correctly, but there were a lot of parts that I can reuse, and then how to get the wax onto the buffer like intelligently. So those are my, gotta get that. I would like to get that done before November because we are going to be slammed here shortly, and hopefully can shave some time.
Awesome.
So as you know, I beg Jim to make content for me. So I also need you to make content of how you made this machine, because this is what I do at nights. Like, I need more content. Please. Sounds so good.
That's what I do as well. Yeah, I should just get out the camera more often. It's funny because like I'm pretty like private as a person, so I'm always like, oh, I don't know. But like, yeah, it's it's more fun if you just take a quick video and share what you're working on and stop
you could
hiding.
Just send it to me privately. That's fine.
I know, selfishly, just private videos.
There we go. Exactly.
Don't need to share it with anyone else.
Jim, when I think you had the robot cabinet open. I was like, oh yeah, that looks exactly like what I was doing last week.
Yeah.
I was reprogramming. Like, I bought the VFD that was in there was locked by the factory, and I could not figure out how to get it unlocked to change the parameters. So I just bought a new one on Amazon. It's so crazy how cheap they are. Like, with a spindle, with a 3-horse spindle and a VFD, it's like $270 or something like that. I'm sure it won't last as long as like a nice one, but like totally does the trick. But I was reprogramming, resetting the parameters for it to try and slow it down for like an appropriate buffer speed, and I was just like, oh, frequency, yeah, just change the frequency. So I went through and like changed all the frequency. I've been working on this for like a week, and this was like the last thing. Like, it was working, it was feeding the material. I just needed to slow it down a little bit, but I changed the wrong frequency, and it just immediately fried the thing. Like, thermal overload. Didn't catch on fire, but like was really close to catching. It was like hot enough that I hurt my hands taking it out. It smelled terrible. And like, that was at like 4:30 on my last day of work for the week. And I was like, damn, I was so close. But yeah, just got the new one in today, so up and running again.
Sick. So many questions. I just searched in my Notion like database thing. I searched UR, and there's a copy of the video that you sent us saved in there. Like, you've got some cool like job workflow management stuff going on. Like, there appears to be maybe a touch screen above like the UR line where you can select different products and operations. Like, you've obviously built all of that stuff yourself. And like, what's your job on order management software stack look like?
We just switched this year to Odoo, which I really like. I was using, we're on Shopify as well. And so I was basically just managing most of that stuff, managing orders through Shopify. I built a custom like label generator for the guy who's running the shipping station, because most people are ordering multiple products, and each one goes in a different box. But to do that on Shopify, you have to like do it one at a time. And it was just a giant pain in the ass. So we've got custom software that we're still using for that at the moment. It's just it prints the appropriate labels and sends the customer the notification that it's come out. But we switched to Odoo for inventory management this year, and it's been great. There's like a nice sync between Shopify and Odoo that's made by EmmyPro. But I just did my like Q4 material ordering. The impetus to do that was we kept running out of stuff last year, and my spreadsheets and trying to figure it out manually was just not working. So this year, doing Q4 ordering, I was able we have enough sales history data where like I can kind of guess what Q4 is going to be based on Q3. But I was able to just say like, how much of every one of these materials did we use in Q3, and then just like do a multiplier for Q4. And I like, it took like a day to basically get, I didn't get everything ordered, but I know what I need to order. So got most of that stuff out yesterday. That's been a big unlock for just not running out of stuff. What's nice is within Odoo, it's inventory management, but it's got a really good manufacturing module as well. So you can define all your parts. Like, most of our products have, let's say there's 5 parts or 6 parts. If you get you can kind of define your min and max inventory levels for those parts. And when I get an order from Shopify, if it's going to pull below the minimum inventory for like the finished good, it will put in a new order for the finished good. And if there's not enough parts, it will put in a new order for the components. So like, the guys who are running the CNC, like, there's just a screen out there that tells them like, this is what we're running today. And that's, when we first started, I was like checking it all the time. But like, since then, it's like pretty much fully automated. It just tells you what to make. It's been good.
That's awesome. Very cool.
I'm back, baby. You thought I died, didn't you? In a world where you freeload off Jem and Justin's hard work, one monthly donation stands between you and being a cheapskate. Support Parts Department on Patreon. Don't be that guy.
I get the sense, seeing some of your photos, like you don't post many shop photos on your sort of main feed, but you sit on some significant stockpiles of plywood, maybe. Is that a hangover from having been burnt?
Yes.
During COVID?
Yes, yes. It's at our worst, like fully half of the shop floor was just stacked floor to ceiling plywood. Because I was, all my suppliers were like, I have this on hand in the States now, and I have no idea when we're going to be able to get any more. So I just
They were doing that to me too, yeah.
That was my cash flow, because I bought as much as I could, like borrow money to buy. And that was why we almost ran out of money. But I've got two storage containers outside, and I'm usually sitting on not many, like a couple weeks worth of material, but especially like this year for holiday season, like I'm going to get more on hand, because some stuff takes, either you can't get it, which is like the worst nightmare, or, you know, it's 6 weeks out and like that won't do me any good in December 1st. So I'm just going to try and hold more, put it in a storage container and pull it out as we need it. But we're sitting, like most of that stuff in the photos is finished good, well, work in progress inventory. Like we've got like 700 cases ready to go for this winter. We had, I've started working with University of Cincinnati's industrial design school. I've got a buddy that teaches there and kind of kept being like, do you have any students that would like to work using their hands? And eventually he sent me one, and it was just a great fit. Industrial design student who didn't want to make shoes or cars, but like wanted to make furniture. And so he worked here for 3 months, and then he went back to school and started telling other people. So now we've got a good source for people who are interested in design, interested in making. It's not what they're going to do with their career, but like it's really good experience, especially if they're, some of them are pretty entrepreneurial as well. Long story, we had more people working than we needed to over the summer, so we just built up a shitload of inventory, and it's just like stacked up.
Yeah.
Which at the time I was freaking out about. I was like, where am I going to put it? But now it's like, okay, that was good. It's ready. We're not going to be so behind the eight ball.
Amazing. That's cool.
So I'm curious, this is going to go back a little bit, but is there any good stories, or like, how did you dig out of not having inventory of plywood during the Russian invasion scenario?
Are you back on the birch train?
Yeah, I bought enough for it was probably 6 to 8 months worth of production when I was being told it was going to be unavailable. And then I stopped all our advertising, let everybody go, like just cut everything back to just me. And so it became 2 years plus worth of inventory. So by the time we finished that initial order, it was 2024 and things were available again. I mean, the prices are higher than they were pre-war, but I'm still able to get it, which of course it's the only country that's not tariffed. So one thing that's working out. So,
you know, what's interesting about that too, I was getting the same story, and I bought like way less than you, but at the time we were looking into like making a product line out of it. And I had like this, my local vendors being like, I'm down in California at the dock. I'm waiting for a ship to come in. So if you want to get some, get it. It was like almost like fear mongering in a certain sense of it's all going to run out. It never ran out for me. I could get it the entire time. It went up, it like doubled in price, but maybe there was truth in that and they really didn't know. I don't feel like my local vendors are that nasty, but I heard the story similarly across.
I think I'm sure there was some genuine, I don't know what's going to happen, but there was also like, well, I don't want to get it. It's triple the price. You got to buy it now or somebody else
record
is going
sales.
To. Exactly. So I'm sure, I got burned, but looking back, I don't know that I would do anything differently. Because I had already sold most of that, like not most of it, but I had sold a significant quantity of that product. So it was either like give everybody back money that I'd already spent or figure out a way to kind of struggle through.
Right.
It was a good, one of the most important, like I thought I understood my books at the time, but I couldn't, kept being like, we're profitable this month, but like there's less money in the bank. I thought if you hit profitable, there should be more. It's like, no, there's this thing called cash flow. Like that's important too. So that was like, in addition to getting good at automation, like understanding how the finances of the business work was really a painful but good learning experience from that time.
Right.
It sounds like you're banking a lot of your cash in raw material.
I don't know what percentage of cash we have in raw material, but we've got a good chunk of our balance sheet is in inventory, either finished goods or raw material.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's a good looking product.
Did that end up changing anything about the product? Did you change design? Did you change material sourcing, or just keep more on hand?
Just keep more on hand, and we raised our prices a lot because material prices went up. That was the other thing. I think that's even when we had, when we were a big shop, there was 10 or 11 people here. We still were not like, we were doing a lot of volume, but like I wasn't making much money off of that. And it's because our pricing was too low. Like I wanted it to be an affordable product to like my own detriment. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, that's, you know, at some point you just got to do it. And I would like to, like, I think we're going to get to a point where our gross margins have been increasing. So I think we're going to be able to bring pricing down a bit again in the future, which is like, it's crazy to think about, but it would be nice to, I don't like charging almost $200 for a wooden box. Like it does seem high, but you know, that's kind of what is a sustainable price for us. But if we can keep getting stuff, if we can get better at making it, then we can bring stuff down.
It's funny, isn't it? Like, because we sell a lot of record cubes in our clip crate system, and you know, simple crates that used to be just glued and nailed together were like our bread and butter for 10 years before we did the clip crate stuff. And now, like, the price of a crate in my mind is so high, like after all the material rises and actual just like knowing our numbers better sometimes, like, and they're still selling quite well, and I'm just like, an order comes in and I'm just like, What are people doing? Like, so I often have this moment of like, who's buying this stuff? Like, really? Yep. Just bought 10 more crates. Wow. Yeah, okay, great. Thanks.
I mean, yeah, like I love it. But yeah, there are times like I have our stuff at home because I make it. I get it for free. But like, yes. I appreciate that our clients really like our stuff. And somebody wrote in the other day. And it was like, it wasn't rude at all. He was very considerate. He was like, you know, just, this is insane. Like your prices are way too high. And I was like, I wrote back like, this is why the way they are, we use really high quality materials. Mm. Everybody here starts at 25 an hour. Like most people are making a lot more than that. Like I want these to be good jobs. And like, I want to have I don't want to be poor either. And like, they're not for everybody. Like it's the way it is, like, you know, but our customers really, really like them. And so like, this has been a model this is a model that works for us. You know, I understand that it's not for everybody, but yeah.
Totally.
She just wrote back and gone like, yeah, it is pretty crazy, isn't it?
It's totally insane.
I mean, people keep paying for this
until they
looking
don't.
Around. Yeah. Looking around online, it looks like you've got a great reputation, and like your products seem really well loved in terms of your users. So that's cool to see.
Yeah.
What's sort of been like? I assume like us, like the business side of things, you've kind of just learnt on the job. What have been some of your kind of biggest turtles or learnings as a business owner and operator?
I'm still not great at managing people, but I was really bad at it for a very long time. And part of that was like, I'm a control freak. I'm a perfectionist. Like I've been doing this for a long time, so I'm decent at it. And a lot of people that I was hiring weren't any of those things. So there was a little bit of like bad fit, but also just like I didn't have the personal skills to, you know, get people where they needed to go, or if it became clear at some point that they weren't going to be a good fit, to like somehow gracefully end that relationship. So that's been, that was, I would say that that's been my hardest challenge to learn, and I'm still not great at it, but I think I've gotten better at it, I think. And the guys at the shop listen to this, so they can tell me afterwards, but I think most of them like working here most days. So
we'll pop a poll in the show notes. They can vote.
Yeah, exactly. Please hide the results from me.
I want to know. Anonymous.
It is anonymous, yeah.
Anonymous.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can definitely relate to that. Oh, it sounds like you're running a smaller team, a tighter operation these days, which, yeah, I'm doing as well. And I definitely do not miss wearing the HR hat. It's a delight not to have to sort of engage with that stuff as much when we had a bigger team of sort of 10-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not, I feel really lucky now. Like everyone, I think everyone here is, they're a great fit. They all bust their asses the whole time they're here, but like they each have their, they each have slightly different skill sets. So it's like, and they've kind of found where they excel in the shop. So there's one guy who's got more traditional woodworking skills and more, he's just better, you know, he's been doing it for longer. He's got more tricks in his back pocket when something's not quite right. He knows how to fix it. And there's the younger guy who's like, it's pretty funny. Like when he came on, there was one other, he was like kind of at the front end of one of the lines, and there was another person at the back end of the line. And it's always kind of like, he was making product that the other person was sanding and finishing off basically. And so it's like, who's going to win the race today? And Ian like pretty quickly was like, I could tell like the other guy won. And then like the next day Ian kind of stepped up. So it's like, he's like, you know, there was something that was like, okay, that's a good, you're going to be a good fit here. Yeah, so he's awesome. He's a hustler. He can just make boxes for 8 hours, and you know, he's starting to learn how to run the router too. So that's the other thing, is like, been trying to think about how to get these people, or like give them opportunity to skill up. And you know, it's nice, because like the more we can pass down from, like, I've got a foreman who I taught to do most of the stuff I used to do, and now he's passing some of his stuff on to Ian. So like everybody's, you know, everybody makes a little bit more money, and everybody's got a little bit more interesting job when they can, you know, run a router and put stuff together. You're not just putting glue in a crack all day.
Yeah. And are you solely responsible for sort of shop improvement stuff, or it's like, do they have a sense of that they can do some of that as well? Or does that kind of all fall on your...
I do the work, but it's 100% like what's not working for you, you know? But yeah, it's been a nice breakdown where like, basically like we've got a long list of like things that need to happen. And I'm sure there's some things that are like, have been sleeping for too long, but, yeah, if there's like an urgent problem that they're having, we bump it to the top, take care of it right away. But yeah, it's works well, because that way we're able to keep meeting customer demand. Like those guys are still cranking stuff out while I'm able to, like, you know, improve something or fix something or just rearrange our flow.
Yeah. Awesome.
Sure. So I'm kind of curious, like when you think about potential new products, I'm assuming it's earlier in the year, not in your crunch time. When you do, how much does your production line limit your thinking about that, or do you limit your thinking about that? Is it hard to bring a new product into the system?
I haven't even tried to bring something that's not in this line in years. Like once we got so specialized on like making this style of product out of this material, it was just like, well, what other shape can it take? Can we add drawers? It's just like all. What new media can we accommodate within the system? But been doing that for 10 years, and I'm like, I've got two more products that are in that family that I want to finish, but they're like They're not that hard. They're mostly developed. We'll try and get those out next year. And I think similarly to like the goal this year was like, think of this as a warehouse. I want to spend next year diversifying our product offering because we are like, we're pretty vulnerable to, luckily vinyl has been super popular and just keeps selling more, but like at some point, you know, it's going to be something else. And I would like to be more resilient, you know, or material shock again. Like I don't want to be so dependent on just the one thing. But it's been funny to like, I think there's two ways to go. So we added a metal base for our product last year. I made the first one and then I had like a friend make the second and third and fourth ones. And then a buddy, the same guy who teaches at UC, was, I asked him like, who do you use for fabrication? So we found this local company that makes like, they do an incredible job. Their prices are pretty reasonable. It's like, oh, that like you don't have to make everything in house. So as I'm like looking for moving forward, I think I'm going to try and outsource most of that, like really just continue to be really good at making the things that we make. But, and you know, if we can, if things that we're designing can work in that system, great. But I probably would be trying to find more and more partners to work with to, it makes you a little bit more nimble. Like you don't have to invest so much to get up and running. It doesn't take you as long to be like at a price point that works. I mean, depending on how you value your time, obviously, but the next year I'm going to try and add some new products in that are not related to these. And probably most of those will be trying to find partners to work with.
Okay, cool.
But it's funny. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, you go. You go.
I was thinking about this, like I'm trained as a designer. That's what I thought I wanted to be. But like looking at how I spent my past 10 years, I think I'm more of like a doer, more operations. Like, so I think I might try and also find some like young talented designers to work with who, we've got a great industrial design school here. I'm sure those guys have ideas that I would never think of, or those guys and gals. So it might be an opportunity there to, you know, really just stay on the execution side and see what other people can think of too.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, it's funny listening to you talk about sort of diversification. I'm struck by the fact that I've been making some form of plywood cube for like 15 years now, and I feel like they're almost like a recession-proof product. Like they endure anything. People always want some form of plywood box to put their crap in.
Yes, yes.
Whether it's vinyl or anything, like it's a pretty good product base. And yours are obviously beautifully refined, and like I love the little pull-out door system. Lovely detail.
Thank you.
Solves a lot of things. So yeah. Super cool, but yeah, I can see you could probably just keep on making plywood boxes forever, and that would be okay.
It's fine. I think I've been through just one major, like the COVID recession, and like that was goofy. Like there was so much money that was given out to people, so it didn't really hit. But like, we're also in a market that's like most of our consumers are pretty affluent anyway. So I feel lucky that we're not. Even when the economy does have downturns, like we don't see too much. People aren't pulling back too much on our stuff. I'm sure, like knock on wood, now that I've said that, stuff's going to hit the fan, but yeah.
Yeah. Cool. What else? What else? What else?
I'm sure I've got. You got
any questions for us?
I'm sure I do, Jim. So, like, and I didn't start listening early enough. What happened with? Why did you go from a big 10-person team to a smaller team? Like, what was the impetus for that for you?
Basically, stuffed up. Tried really actively to grow for about 2 years. Was in a business coaching program, and they pushed us really hard to grow, capitalize. And we're like, yep, let's do this. And got it wrong. In short, built a great team, built great systems and tools, never quite hit the revenue targets that required to support such systems. And kind of went a little bit too far without realizing how far back we were going before we pulled the plug. basically, and went back to four. So yeah, very much sort of take responsibility for having got to that point. It was me and my business manager working together on that sort of that growth plan, and we're both in the business coaching program. And probably, you know, the program was great. We learnt heaps, but we're kind of both like kind of in it and probably not seeing the bigger picture well enough. Also, I can relate to the HR stuff. Like I'm terrible at pruning the tree and letting people go who aren't the right fit. And so yeah, we sort of ended up in a spot with a great team, but just not the consistent revenue to keep so, that afloat and profitable. Yeah,
I think it's funny that I don't know, maybe it's just because like it's with at least I'm speaking for myself, but like I'm a small business, and so I think some of like when you're trying to grow 5x a year and you're playing with somebody else's money, then it's like a different mindset. Like if the business fails, it's fine. Just like only the investors are going to lose. You know, it's like, okay, we'll just try something else next
time.
Just
your money.
Like, yeah. It's like, no, there's a lot of people like my employees and, you know, my family depending on it. And yeah, it's been, it's funny. I did a business thing that was at the very beginning, they weren't aggressive about pushing like growth, which was nice. But some people I talked to are like that they're in a world where that's the expectation. You know, you're gonna 5x, you're gonna 10x, and like that's fine for some, but like yeah, it's not appropriate for all businesses. And yeah, I think it's nice that there can be businesses that don't have to do that.
Totally. Yeah. And like we're really actively sort of pursuing like almost a degrowth strategy now, where it's like, cool, how do we keep this tight, efficient, no intention of growing? And yeah, I think the world would probably be a better place if more businesses were engaging with ideas like that. But yeah.
Justin, on that note too, like how did you decide to get into tool distributing? That was like, how did that happen?
Like CNC tools or just different,
I guess,
like wholesaling,
more wholesaling, or like the, like you added hand tools, you added torque wrenches, that kind of stuff.
Right. I think the original version of that was we went from like our first three products were the dust boot, the duck tower, and then the ATC pedestals. And I mean, in a certain way, they took a lot out of me just to get accomplished, and like the struggles of not fully testing those well enough. I think that I was like, all right, well, we've got this series of products that people are coming to buy. And I noticed that everything I would add to the shop was an opportunity for somebody to add that item to the shop. And I've had this conversation multiple times with different, on the phone, over email, with different, basically like business owners like ourselves that run businesses with CNC routers that are like, what else can I buy? Literally, they say that. And I'm not like, you know, I'm not much of a salesperson, but you know, when somebody says that, you're like, well, I've got this, you know, this handbag over here I take stuff home with.
What
like,
do you want?
Yeah, I'm just literally like, what else can I sell you? I don't know. Yeah. And so where I came to with that was like, well, instead of coming up with a bunch of unique products, we were starting to sell tool holders too, because that was something that was hard to find, and people with routers, even like myself, weren't. There's the specs and things. You buy a machine, that kind of come with them, and you don't really know what they are. So like we had some internet following where I kind of gathered that all together. I was like, all right, well, we need a torque wrench to tighten those because they kind of get messed up. Where would you get those? And so I kind of stumbled into Technics. I'd already been buying their collets myself and I liked them. And they had like, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 SKUs. Took me a while to like get connected and get approved as a distributor. But I mean, that's turned out to be a pretty good relationship. It's still an interesting game, similar to maybe like you buying plywood, me buying a bunch of collets and selling them. I'm making like nothing on that. And if you look at like the competitive market, it's, I think a lot of companies are like loss leading that kind of stuff. But it does help in that people come back to us for those things. They rely on them. And then just like, you know, adding Vera recently, similar idea of like, I wanted more, like we have some products coming out around needing different torque tools, torquing tools, hand tools. We didn't really have anything like that. And I'm just kind of trying to become a source for people that want to solve those problems. And often, I think a lot of it is a convenience factor of like, if you're trying to buy for your CNC router, you don't want to go source six different things. You're like, oh, PDX CNC has all these things. I'm going to buy it here. So that's yep. that's my goal in the end.
Does that, it seems like that would dovetail well with the, are you still doing the consulting stuff? Like, I mean, I know that's a small part of
it,
but like that presence in the community.
Yeah. Right. I found it to be an interesting, the consulting's interesting. Like I just had a company from a local company that had a different brand of router and used different software than I'm used to contact me. And this has happened a few times where I'm like, I'm advertising consulting to a certain extent, like on a couple website posts. And then they contact me. I'm like, I can't help you with any of that. Like, I don't know. I don't, I'm not going to try and charge you money to like learn to help you. Yeah. But you know, when it hits my Venn diagram well with like, you know, Fusion and something similar to ShopSavers, yeah, that I haven't really, it hasn't necessarily turned into a lot of product sales, but I can imagine that relationship happening. And, you know, people that come for our training classes often are pretty new, and then somewhere down the road they'll end up buying some product from us too. So that's kind of like a nice like introduction to, I didn't know these options were out there.
Yep.
My internet marketing's not working, for example, which is the only other thing I wanted to ask you about on my list.
Yeah, it's funny when you were talking, I was like, as I know it, I think you were at some point, you're like, how do I 2X? I'm like, just 2X your marketing spend.
you did message me that. And I was like, oh yeah.
There's, when I started, I was doing all my, like managing all that stuff myself, but I've, at some point when we had a larger team, I met this guy at a soccer game, like pre-gaming at a bar. And it just happened to work out. Like he was good at marketing. He's a very multi-talented person. So it was nice because I couldn't hire just a marketer, but I could hire a marketer who could also design stuff. And like, he was good with electronics. Mm-hmm. He designed some really cool speakers for us that are like in the Cube form factor that we still haven't sold because that's like a can of worms I don't really want to open
speakers.
Yet.
Speakers.
Yeah, they sound great. They look nice, but I don't want to get into that yet. But anyways, he took over that stuff, and that was, it was really, he was really successful at it. He doubled our business in a year. And it's just like, he knew which buttons to push inside the Facebook ad manager to do it. But when we got much smaller, we had to let him go. And since then I've been working with, an ad guy who just buys Facebook and Meta and Google ads for me. I still do all the creatives for it, but like he's in there daily or every other day, like, you know, tweaking the little knobs to make sure that they're
really
performing. So I'd be happy to send you a reference to him. It's been really good. Found him on Upwork. So
awesome. That's cool. So you did the obvious, I think you've answered my question, but you do a digital ad spend. That's part of your business model.
That's like most of, it's about 10% of our, we try to keep it around 10% of our revenue. That's been a good, like I found that that's a good number for us.
Wow. That's a big number. Okay.
Like I know I can be profitable at that, and it drives sales. Like I remember when the first marketing consultant I hired, it was like, I felt like I'd found the gas pedal for the company.
Yeah, interesting.
Like, okay, now I
spending.
Now I can control. Well, like, and it's not just spending. It's like when somebody who knows what they're doing is spending the money for you, it does feel like. Right. I'm sure there's like, you know, there's competition and market saturation. Like you can, we haven't hit that yet. It's nice to be able to like, okay, I can make this many. So let me make sure I'm selling that many. And then when you kind of even that, you're like, well, what if we sell just a little more? Can we trying to keep those two things in balance is. Hard, but
right.
Yeah,
cool.
All right, let's get deep. What's your average ROAS?
It varies. It's usually around, like, it says it's 8 when we blend it across Facebook and Google.
Woo!
I don't know that that's accurate, but yeah, like I just kind of like, because you can't track where all the sales are coming from, like I would just try and make sure like 10% of revenue is like, if we're spending more than that and we're not getting the revenue, then like pull it back. If we're, if that's working, like as long as that's working, just like keep bumping it up a little bit. As you know, as long as we can keep up with the volume.
Impressive. Oh dear. Yeah.
It's kind of accurate for mine too. Yeah. Oh, cool. Interesting. I did no goal for it. I just am like, if it's not selling, I'm just like, nope, pull down.
Yep. Exactly. And there's, I don't understand. Stuff's all a black box to me. It's like, I don't know. And they change it constantly. That is the other thing. Like,
I never change it. Yeah. Just let it sit.
I mean, even the UI, like Facebook's ad manager UI, it feels like every time I log in, there's something new that I don't understand.
It's a new pop-up. That's the thing that kills me. Get out of my face. Yes. I don't want to talk to your fake consultant.
We got locked out of our, long story short, but like my original Facebook account was set up with my undergrad student email, which they stopped supporting last year. And like, I missed the note where they're like, we're not supporting this anymore. So like, I couldn't do the 2FA to log in. And I spent hours on the phone and like messaging with them. And they're like, sorry, we can't reset it. If you can't get to the email, like, we're spending like a decent amount of money with them at the time. So luckily, like, was able to find this weird workaround where like my ad manager, I gave him access and then he gave me access. It was like, we hacked it, but it's like, this is just ridiculous. Like, it's a nightmare. I'm glad I don't have to get in there. Really.
I've heard of that exact thing. I've never worked with anybody else, but I had a friend who was really good at working. He had like advertising help, and he helped me set up stuff a while back. And he said, the one thing to never do is to let the advertising firm set up the account. Because then they have control over it. And not that they're going to like steal your money or do things. It's that when you leave, you don't have any of that data.
Yep.
And they have control over it.
Yep. Yeah. It's like, yeah. But you're also kind of over a barrel. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That's it. That digital advertising's work for us. I'm going to try, like, it's not the most satisfying. So I'm going to try and start doing some print stuff too, just kind of for fun. Throw it in the boxes. Mail it out to interior designers and whatnot. But yeah.
Nice. Shall we
questions.
Ring the bell?
Anything else?
I'm out too.
Ring a ding ding.
To go to a soccer game or something.
Nice.
Yep. Oh.
Well, thanks for joining us, Matt.
My pleasure, guys.
Really appreciate it. Your time, and great to get to know you a little bit more.
Absolutely. We'll keep chatting on the Instagram or whatever.
No doubt.
Right.
Yeah. No, and congrats on sort of 10 years of Box Lord, and I hope to see it continue into the future.
Likewise.
Right.
Very cool.
Cheers.
Yep. Well, if you want to connect with anything Matt does, we'll have links in the show notes.
All the links.
I think that's it.
Sounds good.
Links to Matt's Beaver. No, we won't link to your GitHub. We wouldn't do that.
Well, it's private, so.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
I like we don't know how to end this.
I know. Bye.
Push the button.
Usually I do this.
He disappeared.